Good afternoon. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to welcome you all here to CSIS, and I appreciate your all coming out for the rollout of our new publication, The Vital Triangle, China, the United States, and the Middle East, which you have copies of before you today. My name is John Alterman. I'm the director of the Middle East program here at CSIS and co-author of the book. I will give you a brief presentation about the book, and then I'll be joined by two rather impressive commentators. If you can't hire people smarter than you, at least you can get people smarter than you to talk about your book. Starting off will be Ambassador Nicholas Burns, the former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs in the State Department, also the former permanent representative of the United States to NATO and ambassador to Greece. He's the former State Department spokesman. There are few people with as keen an ability to convey a sense of U.S. strategic thinking and U.S. strategic posturing going into the future than Ambassador Burns. He'll be followed by who I think is probably the best person on earth to talk about this book. Ambassador Chaz Freeman is currently with Projects International in the Middle East Policy Council. He is also the co-chair of the U.S.-China Policy Foundation and the vice chair of the Atlantic Council of the United States. Deep experience in the Arab world, where he was ambassador to Saudi Arabia, deep experience in Asia, where he was deputy chief of mission and chargé d'affaires of the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. Not only a distinguished thinker and writer, but one of the most entertaining speakers, and as I said, one of the most deeply informed on issues of China and the Middle East and the United States. So I'm going to try to do whatever technical wizardry I can to compete with these guys, but it's going to be an uphill battle. This book, The Vital Triangle, is the product of several years of work here at CSIS. I did it with a co-author, John Garver, a professor at Georgia State University. Unfortunately, John is in China this summer and couldn't join us for the rollout. But we engaged with hundreds of people in China, in the Middle East. I went to China twice, spoke with a number of people in the academic community, people in the business community, journalists, and others about this evolving interest of China in the Middle East, the evolving relationship of China in the Middle East. And then we spoke to a whole range of people in the Middle East, not just in the tours that I've done in the Middle East over the last several years, but also we had a conference in Abu Dhabi in the fall, which brought together people from China, the United States, and the Middle East to try to work through these issues. The idea of this project is that you can't really think about China in the Middle East, the United States in the Middle East, without thinking about the relationship of all these parties together, that increasingly the parties are inextricably linked. And there's a way, it seemed to me as I was embarking on the research, that if anybody's happy, if anybody's unhappy, they can make all the other parties unhappy as well. That there's a way in which any single party could be a spoiler if two tried to gang up against one. And understanding this dynamic, understanding the nature of the relationship, would be vital not only to U.S. security, but also to the future of the Middle East and to the future of China. What it seems to me has happened is that the United States has had a long relationship with China. It started off with missionaries in the 19th century. It involved trade before the 19th century and after. Things got cool in the first half of the 20th century, but increasingly over the last 30 years, you've had a very strong relationship to China, which partly has to do with trade, diplomacy, and everything else. That also, starting in the early 20th century, had a U.S. relationship with the Middle East. This relationship was created in many ways in its modern incarnation with the discovery of oil in Saudi Arabia and the way in which oil became a strategic commodity during World War II. And the Middle East suddenly became a strategic nexus for the United States in a way that wasn't the case before. What you've had through the development of the second half of the 20th century is a deepening of the U.S.-Chinese relationship and the U.S.-Middle Eastern relationship. That these relationships are not merely about economics, not merely about diplomacy, but they've taken on issues of counterterrorism, they've taken on issues of how China affects our diplomacy vis-a-vis countries in the Middle East. There's just a much thicker and more complicated relationship between the United States and the countries in the region. And it's not perhaps surprising that they should start thinking about a relationship with each other and not just going through the United States. Now, of course, it's not merely the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, and it's not merely the Chinese relationship with Saudi Arabia, because it's Iran, it's Kuwait, that's Oman, which is very important to China, and Iraq. You have all of these complexities coming into the relationship. And the sense that you could merely have a U.S.-Chinese relationship, a U.S.-Middle Eastern relationship, without taking account of this triangle is increasingly hard in any of the bilateral relationships, and certainly when you start thinking about the region as a whole. The appeal of China to these countries in the Middle East is, I think, well summarized by this quote by Abdulaziz Sagar. He's a Saudi who lives in Dubai, and he said, the chief advantage of China's role in the region is its lack of political baggage. There's an attraction of the idea of bringing in China as a serious power. But the U.S. reservations about this are captured by John McCain's statement about how China is hindering the U.S. China is an obstacle to the U.S. accomplishing its policy, not only in the Middle East, but farther afield. And that tension, as I said, if everybody's not happy, there's a way in which everybody becomes unhappy, and that's a problem. Ultimately, the core of this relationship is an energy relationship. China's energy consumption is going up, and their production is flat. They became a net energy importer, net oil importer in 1993. We have been importing oil for a long time, and our needs continue to increase. And where's the oil? I mean, the fact is we're going to need oil for a long time to come. If you look at the Energy Information Administration's projections, for 2001, about 39% of our energy came from oil, 23% from natural gas and coal and otherwise. But even going forward into 2030, 32% of energy comes from oil. That's global energy shares. The 2030 pie, by the way, is a much larger pie because countries are developing, countries are growing, they're using more energy, so the world is going to continue to need oil. And where is that oil? Well, if you look at proven reserves around the world, we've got some. The Canadians have a lot, but it's tied up in tar sands. It's hard to get out, right? And you look around the world, not so much, not so much. Africa, yeah, there you go. I mean, it's obvious that we are going to have a growing reliance on Middle Eastern oil. China's going to have a growing reliance on Middle Eastern oil. And merely for the reasons clear in this graph, China's been getting most of its oil from the Middle East because that's where the oil is, right? The green line is Chinese imported oil coming from the Middle East. That's about half, consistently half. They're getting more from Africa. That's the blue line. A lot of that's from Angola, which is actually their number one oil exporter right now. But if this is all in a time when Chinese demand is going through the roof and the only countries that can really meet this growing Chinese demand are coming out of the Middle East. For this reason, you're seeing growing Chinese trade with the Middle East. Bilateral trade has been shooting up. It's shooting up principally from oil exporting countries, Saudi Arabia, Iran, the UAE. That's the bulk of that growth. The interesting thing about this is even while you're seeing this bilateral trade with China increasing, even while you're seeing this, trade with the Middle East is about 5% of China's global trade, or less than 5%. That this is part of a big picture where the Middle East is strategically troubling to China, strategically enticing to China, but economically, it's not the biggest part of the Chinese economy. The problem is what happens if there's an interruption in oil. So what's China exporting to the Middle East as part of this trade? They're exporting the things they export to much of the world. Machinery and transportation equipment's the biggest part, sort of semi-manufactured, cheap manufactured goods, textiles and clothing. That's the bulk of it. And what are they importing? They're importing oil. Chinese imports are around 80% oil. That's what these countries export anyway. It's not special with China, and it's significant. So how does China see all of this? It seems to me that as China looks at the Middle East, they feel deeply vulnerable. A number of people spoke to us about the sense they have in China that they're very uncomfortable relying on foreign sources of energy. They're very uncomfortable relying on the United States to protect their foreign sources of energy. There's a sense that a lot of people had, and I'm not a China expert, as I think everybody in this room knows, but certainly I heard any number of people repeating the same narrative about the sense that the U.S. is a hegemonic power that seeks to control the world by getting a grip on world sources of oil, and that is a source of vulnerability for China. The fact that China cannot protect its own sea lanes of communication, the fact the U.S. is acting in the Middle East, in Chinese eyes, creating instability in the Middle East, makes China the more vulnerable of the parties. They also think that for all the imperialism and arrogance that they associate with U.S. foreign policy, they feel so much less able to handle instability in the Middle East than the United States does. That is, they feel that we're going shaking things up, but because we have a stronger economy, because we are more developed to start with, that there's a way in which what the U.S. does doesn't take sufficient account of their sensitivity, doesn't take sufficient account of their inability to deal with instability, and that's a factor contributing to instability in the region. Now, part of this is that the region gives them the heebie-jeebies. When you talk to Chinese Middle East experts, and they all tell you about how important it is to understand the Middle East, and a lot of them, honestly, they've been to one Middle Eastern country for a couple of months, and they've been to Israel for a couple of 3 months, and that's their Middle East experience. But when you talk to the strategic thinkers, they all saw that graph with 50% of the oil coming from the Middle East as a problem. Because if you look at where the Chinese are actually investing, where's their FDI going to? 1% of their FDI is going to the Middle East. They will trade with the Middle East, 5% of their trade is with the Middle East, but they won't invest in the Middle East because, quite frankly, they think these people are nuts, because they see it as a region full of instability, because they see it as a region where the U.S. has much more control than they do, and they'll invest in Latin America and Africa far before they'll trade with the Middle East, but they won't invest with the Middle East because of a sense. And, you know, maybe it utterly comes down to a sense that as a country of committed secularists, a country which is, or a region that's having a religious resurgence, is deeply unsettling and hard to understand. So as I said, they really won't invest there. I think their other problem in the Middle East, and this goes to the sense of disquiet, is how they relate to Iran. Iran also gives them the heebie-jeebies. They're trying to avoid a confrontation. It seems to me the best way to capture the Chinese relationship to Iran is that they are desperate to balance against whichever side, the U.S. or Iran, is leaning more toward confrontation. That is, the more the U.S. seems to be tipping toward war, the more they'll side with Iran to keep the U.S. from going toward war. And the more they see the Iranians being confrontational, the more they'll side with the U.S. to get the Iranians to back down. It's not a clear policy, it's a subtle policy. And it's a policy where you have to look not only at what they do, but at the timing of what they do. My co-author, who follows Chinese foreign policy with a patience and intimacy that I can't summon myself, talked about had the Iranian-Chinese oil deal on the Yadavaran field was sort of concluded but not quite consummated for several years because they wanted to get the benefit from the Iranians of making the deal, but they didn't want to antagonize the United States. And you actually didn't see this deal implemented until the NIE came out in December 2007. So the Chinese sort of kept the Iranians on a string, sort of said, oh, yeah, we have a $100 billion oil deal, gas, we're doing all these things, but didn't actually make the deal, didn't actually move forward on the deal until the U.S. had certified that Iran wasn't moving forward on a nuclear weapons program. He sees that, as he looks at Chinese foreign policy, as a way that the Chinese are being sensitive to American sensibilities, not antagonizing the United States, because ultimately the key strategic relationship for China is its bilateral relationship with the United States. It has a national security vulnerability on energy supply, which, as I said, Chinese lose sleep overnight about the fact that their energy security relies on the Middle East. But all of China's diplomatic standing in the world has to do with the Sino-American relationship, and the Middle East is in some ways subservient. What the Chinese are doing, especially on Iran, is balancing between the two, and doing so in a quite artful way. When you look at the regions, at the countries in the Middle East, virtually all the countries in the region are aligned with the United States. I think one of the underappreciated facts about the second half of the 20th century is that virtually all the governments in the region are aligned with the United States. The people are another issue, but the governments are with us. We maintain military order. But there's this sinking suspicion that the U.S. needs a balancer, that an unconstrained United States really isn't in the interest of the region, really doesn't further regional goals, that there's all this talk about energy independence in the United States. You see flattening energy demand. And that there's a way in which supplementing this strong bilateral relationship to the United States with a relationship with China, a growing economy, growing demand for energy, and a very studied disinterest in internal intervention and involvement in internal affairs is a helpful way to secure these countries' interests going forward. I think there's also a way in which the Chinese relationship with countries in the region is sort of happily unsentimental, right? When the United States has a relationship, especially with the Middle East, we talk about Arab-Israeli stuff, we talk about Islamic extremism, we talk about counterterrorism. There's a shrillness and a level of debating back and forth about, are these guys really our friends? And you see it on the Arab side, you see it on the U.S. side, you see it on the Iranian side. And there's a way in which there's sort of a refreshing commercialness to the relationship with China. We make a deal, we move on. That I think a lot of the countries find refreshing and that China sees as an added advantage moving forward. The U.S. relationship is deeply focused on the Middle East. CENTCOM in Tampa has more people in Tampa than the State Department has in Washington, D.C. Right? CENTCOM, just looking after U.S. military interests in the Middle East, has more people in Tampa than the entire State Department has looking after the entire world. One estimate suggested that we spend $33 billion a year protecting oil exports from the Middle East. $33 billion a year. That's a number, by the way, that China doesn't contribute to. China benefits from it. China benefits tremendously from it. But it's not something that they pay into. I think there's a certain tendency in the United States to see China's rise principally in military terms. there's a sense of China as a challenge to the United States, China undermining U.S. policy, China making deals with countries the U.S. is trying to isolate. Overall, it seems to me that there's this remarkable disparity. The U.S. continues to invest in security in the Middle East, and the Chinese continue to reap the benefits of U.S. investments in security in the Middle East. The U.S. principal victory vis-a-vis China in the Middle East has been to get the Chinese to limit their arms sales to countries like Iran. China's backed off of supplying missiles and missile technology to Iran. The U.S. has gotten the Israelis to stop selling U.S. Military technology to the Chinese. But that's actually where the great success has been. But it seems to me the great Chinese success has been benefiting from this relationship from the Pax Americana that the U.S. has helped set up. So after going through all of this, and I've given you a taste, and you'll have to read the book to get more, what are the conclusions of this? It seems to me that the first conclusion is that the U.S. interests in the Middle East are strategic and enduring. They're not going anywhere. We are going to stay deeply involved in this region of the world for a very long time. Chinese interests in the Middle East are significant and growing. There is no way that China isn't going to have more and more interest in this part of the world, partly for reasons of energy security, but also as China becomes more and more of a global power. This is going to remain a significant part of the world, and China will want to be significant in it. And the Middle East interests in China are evolving. There's a curiosity about China, a curiosity of what the relationship with China can be, not because China can replace the United States, but because people are curious about the ways in which China can supplement the United States. There's a real interest in having China supplement the U.S. as it goes forward. So what do we do about any of this? One thing that we came down to is we have to build on common interests in security, that there's a way in which China has not contributed to regional security exercises while it's benefited from them. So building on security by doing sort of technical things like ship protocols and cargo identification, starting with the easy things, the things that are very technical, that are not emotional, to create an expectation of Chinese involvement. Talk about consequence management. Right? If you have accidents in the Gulf especially, bringing the Chinese into this, I think, is a constructive way to reassure people about American intentions, to get the Chinese to help, to create an increased Chinese interest in maintaining security in the region. We thought it would be useful to create some sort of security net framework that unites consumers and producers. China has set up this Shanghai Cooperation organization, which brings together a number of people who aren't especially our friends. But it doesn't seem to me that contributes to really accentuating, developing our shared interests, that there's a way in which having a framework where China and the U.S. and countries that are friendly with us and countries that are hostile from us, all centering on what it is that we share, developing common interests, is a useful framework, if only to create a framework to diffuse some of the tensions in the region. Ultimately, the challenge for the U.S. is how to create a constructive role for China moving forward. China's not going away. China's oil demand's not going away. Our oil demand's not going away. And we're going to have to find a way to do this going forward. The strange thing about these relationships is that the Chinese-Middle Eastern relationships are not relationships that people in either China or the Middle East are especially fond of talking about, at least talking about with Americans. I've spoken with Chinese foreign ministry officials. I feel like it's, you know, police at an accident scene saying, nothing to see here, guys, move on. Spoken to Chinese diplomats who said, oh, there's nothing really going on. Arab diplomats and scholars who say, well, you know, it's not much, don't. But there's a way in which, there, but there, you know, if you look at the subtle signs, the number of Arabs who are studying in China, who are studying Chinese, exchange students back and forth, a number of businessmen who go back and forth. There is a sense in which, in a completely unemotional way, people in this region, people in the Middle East, people in China understand that they are going to have to understand more about each other, and they're not going to be going through the United States. U.S. interests require that we understand that evolving relationship and we steer it in a constructive way so that all of us can have our interests met, because if we don't, then none of our interests will be met. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Nick Burns. I'm very pleased to be here. I want to thank CSIS and John Alterman for this opportunity. I'm very pleased to be with Chas Freeman. I think John's right. Given Chas's career involvement in the Middle East and China, there's probably nobody better in this town to discuss this subject. But you got me first. You'll have to listen to me. I'll be the warm-up act. A lot of people, a lot of friends in the room, Ambassador Jim Sasser, who was a great American ambassador to China for President Clinton, Bud McFarlane is here, Ambassador Henrik Liljegren, former Swedish ambassador to the United States, and my friend Justin Higgins, who worked with me at NATO. He's a young American Foreign Service officer now serving on our China desk at the State Department. So we are among friends. I have a few things to say about this topic. I thought it was an excellent study. And when I thought about it in its largest dimension, it's obvious, isn't it, that the vital triangle deals with, I think, what one could argue to be the two vital issues for American foreign policy for the next 10 to 25 years. The first is the rise of China, a China that will be, without any question, the most dynamic and consequential partner for the United States, good or ill, as we move forward into a new American administration. The second is the rise of the Middle East to become the place where the U.S. strategic attention is most engaged. I think of it this way. The Middle East is for the 21st century, for the United States, what Europe was for the 20th century. Between roughly the First World War, when Woodrow Wilson put our troops into the Western Front, to the time when Bill Clinton put American troops into Kosovo in 1999, our foreign policy was global. We were active in every part of the world, but it was really all about Europe, because that's where the mortal dangers lurked for the United States through the rise of fascism in the 20s. The Second World War, the five decades of the Cold War, and certainly the four Balkan Wars of the 1990s. The Middle East has now occupied that space, certainly for the Bush administration, over the last 7 years, and I think it will for an Obama or McCain administration. So I think the question that this study deals with is not only topical, it's really quite vital for the United States of America. And the question I would ask is the following. Is China going to participate with the United States in trying to resolve the major problems of the Middle East, the problems that will be evident to President Obama or President McCain when they walk into the Oval Office for the first time, probably after the swearing-in and inaugural parade on January 20th, 2009, one of those two men will come back to the Oval Office, and the National Security Advisor, he or she, will be there. And you can picture the scene. There'll be some world leaders who'll want to call the new president to congratulate him. And if I were the National Security Advisor and had a chance to give that new president a sense of what that president is facing, I'd start with the Middle East. I mean, think of the American agenda in the Middle East. 160,000 American troops in Iraq, and no plan yet to extricate them with honor and with success. And we'll see if either of the presidential candidates can develop a plan that's convincing to the American people. That's first and foremost. Next, there's the strategic challenge posed by Iran in two dimensions. Iran is the largest funder and supplier of arms to nearly all the Middle East terrorist groups that are shooting at us and shooting at the moderate Palestinians and shooting at the Israelis and the Lebanese. Think of that. Iran supplies money and arms to Hamas, to Hezbollah, to Palestinian Islamic Jihad, to the Shia militants in Iraq who have been fighting our soldiers, and now to the Taliban in Afghanistan. The second Iranian challenge is the attempt by the Iranians to create a nuclear weapons capability, a nuclear future. We think beyond enrichment, I think personally, beyond enrichment and reprocessing towards the acquiring a nuclear weapons capability in the future. That would be a game changer in the Middle East for American strategic interests and those of all of our friends, including all of those moderate Arab countries that John was talking about. Think of the fact that President Obama or President McCain will have to take that baton from President Bush and Secretary Rice called the Middle East peace negotiations. The fact that 60 years after the creation of Israel, Israel has no security and the Palestinians have no justice and no homeland. Think of another priority, Lebanon. Lebanon, a democratic Lebanon, can it survive what seems to be an attempt by Syria, Iran, and Hezbollah to unseat the democratically elected government of Lebanon itself? And beyond that, think of the question that this study is really focused on, the fact that both the United States and China seem to have a vital interest in the safe and secure flow of gas and oil from the Persian Gulf, from an American perspective, not just to the United States, but to all of our allies, treaty allies in Europe, and our treaty allies in East Asia. So if you're an American president looking at the Middle East, you have reason to assert that the Middle East is the most important part of the world to our country. It's the place where things can go terribly wrong and where our vital interests are engaged. And the Chinese need to understand that. I don't question the facts. It's hard to question facts. I don't question the fact that the Middle East is an area of growing importance to China and that the free flow of oil and gas to China is vital for that country. But the Chinese need to understand the primacy of the Middle East for the United States. And the question is, will China begin to use its power, its political power, the leverage that it has with countries in that region to help the United States and other countries to resolve some of the problems that I just listed? Let's take the case, a case in point, Iran. Over the last 3 years until I left the U.S. government a couple of months ago, I was the American negotiator on the Iranian nuclear question. And I spent a lot of time with the Chinese and the Russians and the British and French and Germans and the South Koreans and Japanese and Australians. And the whole point of the international effort was to try to achieve a diplomatic breakthrough and a diplomatic solution, not a military solution, to the problem of Iran trying to acquire a nuclear future. I can say with some, this won't surprise you, with some degree of certainty that China was not at the forefront of that effort. China tended always to be kind of in the back of the pack, in the back of the room, quiet, sitting down at the end of the table, sometimes putting forward ideas, more often than not, playing off what the Russians or the United States or Europeans proposed. So the question on Iran that the new president is going to have is China with us? Is China with us in our attempt to resolve this problem peacefully? Now, the instrument of choice that Russia has chosen and the U.S. and Europe and China have chosen is to offer to Iran the prospect of negotiations with those six countries. It would look a lot like the North Korea, the six-party talks. These would be seven-party talks. The U.S., Russia, China, the three Europeans, and Iran. Iran has turned down, since 2006, for 2 years now, repeated offers by those countries, China, Russia, the U.S., and the Europeans, to negotiate. And so we said if Iran rejected those talks, we would sanction Iran at the Security Council, which we have now done through three Chapter 7 resolutions. But what's been the effect of those sanctions? They haven't been as strong as they should because some of the countries sponsoring the sanctions are also seeking a leading economic relationship with Iran. As the Europeans have pulled back over the last 3 years, 3 years ago the European governments had $22 billion in export credits available to their countries to subsidize business with Iran. They've cut that by more than half, the Germans and French and Italians and Spaniards and Greeks. And as they have left the scene in Iran, as they've decreased their economic ties, China has rushed forward to fill that gap. China is not a leading trade partner with Iran. Chinese exports to Iran and imports from Iran are increasing. At the same time that China is voting for Security Council resolutions, the point of which are to isolate and squeeze the Iranians so they'll be more likely to choose negotiations. So there's a big problem in this effort to sanction Iran, to pressure Iran, to use our combined leverage, because one of the countries, China, is essentially disregarding those sanctions by seeking a favored economic position in Iran itself. And I think this does prompt a larger question. Will China rise to the challenge of global governance? Will China be, as Bob Zoellick said 3 years ago when he was Deputy Secretary of State, will it think of itself as a stakeholder in the international system? Will China realize that it's on the virtual governing board of the world? Now, I said virtual. There is no official governing board of the world, but if you're a practitioner, the way many of us who've been in government have experienced it, there's a virtual governing board of the world. You know, there's the European Union and Japan and Australia and Nigeria and South Africa, Brazil, the United States, and India, and China. It's the group of countries that more often than not are called upon to resolve conflicts, provide troops for UN peacekeeping operations, provide the funding to combat increasingly those global problems that threaten the international system, climate change, trafficking of women and children, international drug cartels, crime cartels, terrorism, WMD, you know, name the issue. All of them lend themselves to multilateral solutions, and all of us think of ourselves as having some global responsibility to combat them. I think there's a question about whether the Chinese actually see that role for themselves. They certainly are powerful economically, politically, and militarily. But do they always think that they can exercise that power, or that they have an obligation to the United Nations or the international system at large to preserve peace, to take active steps with the rest of us to do that? I think the jury is out. Think of the Chinese position on four issues: North Korea, Burma, Sudan, and Iran. My quick report card would be that in North Korea, the Chinese have done very well and have acted very effectively to help the U.S. and Japan and South Korea and Russia to get North Korea to the table, and I hope to move forward with a declaration of what North Korea has been doing for a number of years. On the question of Burma, I don't think the report can be quite as favorable. There's no question that China is the most influential country in Burma by a long mile. And yet we saw after late September, after the dramatic and horrible actions by the Burmese government to put peaceful protesting monks in jail and to crack down on the democratic opposition, we didn't see China move to use its influence to assert that the Burmese government had to act in a more civilized and responsible way. On Sudan, where China has part ownership of the major oil company, China has had a very fitful response to the continuing demand of two UN secretary generals, as well as the U.S. and other countries, that it used that influence to convince the Sudanese government, to permit a UN peacekeeping force to enter Darfur and protect the women and the girls who are still subject, as we speak, to the Janjaweed attacks on them in the Darfur region. And in Iran, as I've already talked about, the Chinese have not used all of their influence, certainly not their economic influence, to join the rest of us in real and effective sanctions. And so for me, this study about China and the Middle East prompts specific questions pertaining to China's role in the Middle East, but also the general questions about China's global activities and about how China looks at its own power in the world and about its willingness to exercise that power. China, of course, like all of us, like all governments, is a complicated government. It has a multiplicity of interests. It seems to me is largely still governed by mercantilistic impulses as the bedrock principle of their foreign policy. Now, all of us, of course, have economic interests and commercial interests. We all want to protect our own companies and advance the success of all of our countries economically. But there are certain issues where sometimes those interests, economic interests, need to be subordinated to the greater good. And the United States and Russia and the European countries have certainly subordinated our economic interests in Iran in a way that China has not. Let me just conclude by saying I looked at the policy recommendations at the back of this study, and I hope all of you will as well. I was intrigued by them. I do agree with John that there are common interests at play here that should unite China and the United States to work together in the Middle East. We both have a decided interest, a clear interest, in preserving the flow of energy to all of our countries. And I was intrigued by John's suggestion in the study that we might be able to work more effectively with China on container security and port security, which has been a global priority for the United States for a number of years, and it would be good to work more actively with China on that. I just don't know. I was trying to think through the suggestion of a security framework. Security frameworks are difficult. I'm not sure what the word framework means. From an American perspective, we do have alliances. We very rarely have more loosely fitting security partnerships, and I wonder what that would look like, and maybe in the question and answer period, John and others might want to contribute to further defining that, because I'm not ready to sign on yet. Security framework and security commitments are very specific, and the United States has to be very careful when it extends commitments of a security nature beyond our country. Last thing I'd say is this. I don't see that the 21st century need be a century of conflict between China and the United States. I think most people in America involved with our foreign policy agree on one thing. We cannot and should not seek to contain China the way we sought and successfully did, in some respects, contain the Soviet Union following the Second World War. Given the degree of economic integration among all of our countries, and specifically between the U.S. and China, given the fact that in a globalized world, we actually should want the Chinese to be working with us on some of those multilateral problems that I mentioned and others that I did not, it seems to me that there's a lot of room for positive engagement between China and the United States, and we should seek that kind of future with China. We should seek, obviously, good and close relations. I think we have them. I think during the Bush administration, the relations have been pretty good between the two countries, not without their problems and disagreements, but pretty good. And that should be the orientation of whatever administration follows that of President Bush. We should seek cooperation certainly in Asia, where the United States thinks of itself as the guarantor of power and has since September 1945, but there's room for us to work with China, in my judgment, and certainly in the Middle East, where I think there's probably more that unites us in terms of those interests that John was talking about and showed us on the slides, more that unites us than divides us. So I'm not at all pessimistic. I don't think that any kind of conflict is inevitable, and I think if we work hard enough, we'll be able to achieve a shared space with China that works for both countries. Final point would be this. If China's feeling vulnerable, as John suggested, or if China or some of the other countries detect a certain shrillness to American policy, those two words leapt out at me. I would bet that with the exception of Iran and possibly Syria, all the countries of the Middle East want the United States to continue to be the dominant external power. They may not always agree with us, issue by issue, but there will be no Middle East peace between Israel and the Palestinians without the active intervention of the United States. There will be no peaceful resolution, obviously, to the Iraq conflict without sound policies and judgment of the United States. And I would assert there will be no peaceful resolution of the Iran problem, which China wants, without the active involvement of the United States. So I don't think that we're facing a future where somehow the United States is going to lose a lot of influence in the Middle East. Fareed Zakaria has written this great new book about American foreign policy where he makes the obvious point. The United States is not losing power in the world, but the United States does have to face a future where other countries are gaining it. And the trick will be, can we cooperate with them? I think there's a lot of room for cooperation between China and the United States in the Middle East. Thank you very much.
Well, John Alderman has, I'm Chaz Freeman. John Alderman has emerged as a major intellectual force and program presence in Washington. Now I understand how he does it. He offers free lunch, gives you a free book. He gets
first person in Washington ever to try that trick, too.
Yeah, he puts on a couple of serious presentations, and then he brings on a clown. So here I am. And he also finds a good topic, because this is the perfect topic for Washington, because it unites the two villains in the American popular psyche, China, which we all know is secretly run by Fu Manchu and preparing to take over the world militarily, and the Arabs, who are everybody's favorite villains. And if you look at the cover of this book, which I invite you to do, you can see the military focus that we bring to bear on these issues. The odd thing, of course, is that Chinese military involvement in the Middle East is virtually nil, and it is we who are the dominant military factor there. At any rate, the involvement with the so-called war on terrorism and the interest of the military-industrial complex in this issue guarantees a good crowd, and I'm glad to see you all here. The second issue is that this, of course, brings together two countries which are the recipients of an avalanche of money. This is these two areas, that is the Gulf. Let's be serious. We're not talking about the Middle East as a whole. We're talking about the Persian Gulf. And China are these are the places to which a huge shift in global wealth and power is occurring. And this avalanche of money, of course, has attracted hordes of investment bankers from Wall Street and fund managers, and it will continue to do so. And so it's very interesting to look at the cross connections between China and the Persian Gulf in the way that we have done. I should say that this book does so very well. It is a major contribution. It puts things in perspective. It is not alarmist. It is factual. And I commend John and his co-author on it. It's very timely. Some of the points that have been made, I will simply underscore. From the Chinese perspective, they don't see themselves as rivaling the United States or attempting to push aside the United States in the Middle East. They haven't been invited to partner with us, so whether they will or won't is a question that has not even been raised except at this forum. They certainly are not prepared to subordinate themselves to us or to underwrite our dominance of the region. Basically, this relationship is fairly simple. Arabs like to sell oil and Chinese like to buy it. And Arabs like to have things built for them and Chinese like to build them. And this is exactly what is going on. It is why, 15 years ago, there were no Chinese to speak of in the Gulf. Now they're well over 200,000. And there are 4,000 Chinese companies operating in the region. And the relationship is exploding. It is going up from a very low base very, very rapidly. What about the Arabs? Well, of course, they see China as the principal and fastest growing market for their principal commodity. I should say the Persians do too. China has distinguished itself in many ways. One of them is that it has an even stupider energy policy than the United States, which encourages consumption, discourages conservation, reduces the pressure for efficiency. I mean, we just don't tax oil very much. They actually subsidize it. So this is great from the point of view of Arabs and Persians because it makes China a huge and growing market. They also see China in many respects as resembling the United States when they first started out with their relationship with us. We were not the UK or France. We had no imperial record in the region. China has no record similar to the United States, which now does have a big footprint and its own agendas in the region. We made no ideological demands on our partners in the Middle East originally. We now do, but the Chinese do not. They just want to lift oil and gas and get on with business. We were powerful and far away, a very desirable partner to have. Now we're powerful and there. That makes us somewhat less desirable. And the Chinese remain far away and are growing in power. There is a hadith, actually, which advises people to go even to China for knowledge, to go so far away from the core of the world to the periphery that China represents. And Arabs look at China as a place with which it is desirable to partner in the future. And finally, they look at China as an increasingly secure and very profitable investment location. You can invest there, and there won't be any crusading attorney general contesting an election who tries to nail you and seize your assets. There isn't any anti-Arab claque that is going to have a role in policy, and your investments will not be frozen by a Chinese version of the Office of Foreign Assets Control, and therefore, China's a good place to invest. But the fact is that the two sides don't know much about each other. Beida, one of China's premier universities, Beijing University, established an Arabic major in 1946, and there are a growing number of institutes of Arab studies and Arabic language centers in China, interestingly staffed and funded, not like ours, from the Levant, from Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Egypt, but from the Gulf, which paid for their establishment. And there are an increasing number of Chinese students, not just in Syria, which was the traditional place to which they went, but all over the place. And as I mentioned, Chinese workers and executives are moving to the region. They know, as Willie Sutton did, where the money is. All of this is new. All of it is going on. There are, as was mentioned, a very large number of Arab students now in China, all over the place. This is also new. It is important. It will grow. And the two societies are, in fact, beginning to learn how to deal with each other. But as John said, in Chinese eyes, the Arab image is quite questionable. It's not very good. I wouldn't say that the Chinese think that Arabs and Persians are nuts, but they may think that they're tricky and unreliable, and in many respects they are influenced by the image that is presented in the American media, which finds its way all around the world, and which obscures the fact that, for example, with regard to oil supplies, it's not the Persian Gulf that is unreliable, but Nigeria, Venezuela, and other places well beyond the Persian Gulf. Well, where is all this going? I think in broad terms, and this gets to next question, which is key, what we are witnessing is part of a broad dilution of U.S. dominance. Nick mentioned China's involvement in Iran. One could also mention India's involvement in Iran. India tends to get a free ride for ideological reasons, but it is very much involved, as Japan has been. India is also involved in Sudan, and I won't dwell on all of this, but I'll just say that what is happening in general is that connections are being made between regions and within regions that have the effect of reducing the American ability to set agendas in those regions. It is clear that these ties will thicken in time and that there will be Arab, Chinese, and Sino-Arab setting of agendas, increasingly in areas like finance, because of all the money that is involved. Islamic finance, for example, is beginning for the first time to find its way into Chinese practice, and it has a bright future. Dubai just established a $1 billion fund for investment in China, and I can tell you from personal experience that there is a very large amount of Arab money moving into investments in China. Similarly, there are Chinese investments, notwithstanding the suspicion Chinese have of Arabs, whom they see much as Arabs see Chinese, as tricky people that are not terribly reliable. There is, for example, a huge new Chinese investment in automotive industry in Iran. And this kind of thing, I suspect, will continue. So We will see in the oil sector, the energy sector, which is the key one, the development of China as a market for the first time for categories of Arab crude, heavy crude, that have lacked markets elsewhere. Refineries are being built that are tuned especially to this kind of oil, and the oil trade is going to go way up. Xi Jinping, who is the vice president of China, just concluded a visit to Saudi Arabia, and there was a prediction for doubling within 5 years of Saudi exports to China in this regard. Similarly, and finally, in the Gulf, the entire petrochemical industry in the world is in the process of migrating to the Persian Gulf for a very simple reason. It's a no-brainer. If you can buy feedstock for your petrochemicals at a discount from the international price and have no transportation costs, that's where you produce your petrochemicals. And so we're going to see China joining Europe and North America in major investments and relationships with in the petrochemical field and others like aluminum in the Gulf. I would sum up by saying that I see this relationship not at all as a threat to American interests, but I see it as an erosion of U.S. ability to control events. It provides added room for maneuver for both those in the area and for the Chinese, and it diminishes the American capacity to set agendas. All of that suggests that there is a future for American diplomacy, because if you can't tell people what to do, then you have to persuade them, and that is what diplomats supposedly know how to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chaz and Nick, for those very thoughtful presentations. We have a little bit of time. If any of you have questions, we have some microphones in the back. If I could ask that you follow three rules, one, that you identify yourself. Second, that until we have a chance for everybody who has a question to ask one, that you ask only one question. And third, that you ask your question in the form of a question, which is to actually ask a question, not make a statement, followed by, what do you think? In the back, Peter.
thank you. Peter Gubser, formerly president of the American Near East FGA, retired. My question is sort of to take your thesis in your book from a triangle to a quadrangle. I would be most curious to hear Nick Burns, an old friend, to talk about it. Add India into the equation, because China, we know, is growing tremendously, but India is too, industrially, high-tech. They're going to have a blue water navy pretty soon, and they're a democracy. How do they fit into this analysis with a new major player coming into the field? Thanks.
Thank you very much. I welcome the question. I actually think that we probably have more strategic upside to our relations with India than just about any other country in the world, and I think there will probably be a greater confluence of American and Indian interests in general, globally, than there will be U.S. and China interests. Not to say that India and the United States are headed for an alliance. We're not. The Indians don't want that, and we don't either. But I do think that President Clinton and President Bush have made a strategic bet on India. They were right to do so, and we're beginning to see some of the fruits of that bet. In the Middle East, I'd like to see the figures, but I'll bet the figures for India are quite modest, economic and trade figures in comparison to China, on certainly in energy. But I would imagine that India is going to have to think very hard now about engineering an increased Indian presence in the Middle East and involvement, because India is facing the same energy crisis essentially that China is. India may not be coping with it as well as the Chinese are. They haven't been as aggressive or expansive in seeking foreign markets. But right now, with the India civil nuclear deal with the United States stalled by a lack of decision in Delhi, and with nuclear power not really an option and only right now 3% of their energy base, And with prices mounting, the Indians are going to have to look overseas more than they have done for sources of oil and gas. So I do expect we'll see more of the Indians. And this question that I posed and that Chas spoke about of, you know, whether or not some of these new powers, rising powers, are in essence measuring up to global responsibility in the way they equip themselves, I think the Indians have done rather well in that regard. But I think there are examples where the Indians have exhibited, in some cases, some of the same impulses as the Chinese. The Indians don't have the type of relationship with Iran that China does. There is very little in the way of military trade between India and Iran. The political relationship isn't as strong, and the economic relationship isn't as strong. And yet the Indians have been quite reluctant to join Russia and the Europeans and the United States in the kind of outward push on the Iranians on the nuclear issue. So some of the same issues that we talk that are evident in the diplomacy between China and the United States about how we act together in the world, some of those are present in India as well. But my sense is that the United States should seek a better relationship with both countries, China and India, but we're more likely to achieve the kind of comprehensive partnership with India, much more likely with India, than we are with China in the future.
A couple of quick comments. India, in investment terms, is only about one-tenth the size of China in terms of what it absorbs in foreign investment. But it has a huge involvement in the Gulf, an enormous expatriate population there, which brings in $20 to $25 billion in remittances annually and is key to India's economic health. Its heavy industrial products and its services increasingly are important in the Gulf economies, and there is a great deal of cross-investment going on. Saudi Arabia, in reaching out to China as a new partner, also reached out to India, and in some respects, India has done better in cultivating that relationship on the commercial side than the Chinese. The final point is that one should not forget that it was not Britain that conquered the Gulf or Iraq. It was British India, Indian troops under British command, defending interests that related India to Europe, not Britain to the region.
Just to underline that, there are more citizens of India in the United Arab Emirates than citizens of the United Arab Emirates in the United Arab Emirates. It's a remarkable figure. Arno, you had a question.
Arno de Borgraf, CSIS. Should hostilities break out between Israel and Iran in the form of airstrikes, I assume the U.S. would get involved one way or another. And where do you think China would stand at that point?
When I was state, Arno, thank you very much for that softball. Really appreciate it.
Now that he's not State Department spokesman, we're not going to let him say, I don't respond to hypotheticals.
Well, I was just about to say that. You know, it's in the DNA of former state spokesmen. We never respond to hypotheticals. I think that we need to work really hard to avoid your hypothetical. And I do not see it as inevitable that there should be a conflict between Iran and the United States or Israel and Iran. I think there's room for diplomacy, and there's time for diplomacy. And I know that Secretary Rice is very focused on diplomacy, and I would hope that whoever follows in 2009 would assume that our first order of business should be seeking a negotiated political outcome with the Iranians on two questions, the nuclear question, and three, on what they're doing in Iraq, which is not helpful at all to the international effort, and what they're doing region-wide, and I referred to that. But I think it's very important that everybody understand that there's room for that diplomatic solution, because the consequences of a war would be horrific, given the size of Iran, given its power, given its relative integration, all comparing favorably to what was present in Iraq before March of 2003. This would be a completely different and much more daunting prospect for anybody seeking an altercation with Iran. And so I think we need to really accentuate diplomacy and give it the kind of effort that we haven't seen to date.
One of the great ironies of the 21st century is that China has emerged as the champion of the UN Charter, sovereignty, and international law. And an attack on Iran of the sort that you posit would occur outside these frameworks. And despite them, China would not be in a position to use its UN Security Council position to do very much of anything. And yet the consequences for China, not simply in terms of the shattering of the framework of law inherited from the 20th century, but also in terms of oil prices and other things, would be huge. I would posit, based on talking to people in the region, that scenario could very well result in the military exclusion of the United States from that region. Some in the region have already been put on notice by Iran that if that occurs, the retaliation will fall first on them. And while Iran is militarily very weak, it is strong in subversive and non-conventional warfare capability. If the United States is no longer able to operate because it lacks overflight rights, access to bases, and a welcome in the region, then the world will be faced with the question of how that region's security, which is vital to the entire world, will be managed. And I don't think the Chinese are ready to step up to that task. I hope they are not challenged, they are not asked to step up to that task, because I do not think it is in anyone's interest to encourage the Chinese to develop power projection capabilities of the sort that would be required if they were to have to take a direct role in protecting their own oil supplies.
Let me just add, I think it's easy to underestimate the Chinese aversion to any war in the region. I think the Chinese see a profound inability to protect themselves from disruption oil supplies, shooting up of prices. It's a real sense of vulnerability. That being said, I think they're sort of indifferent to the nature of the governments in the region. They're indifferent to a change in governments in the region. We have a commitment to stability, sort of more broadly, a sense of projecting stability into societies. There's a profound disinterest in the way societies in the Middle East work in China. And so I don't think that they're necessarily interested in protecting the Islamic Republic. They're interested in not having the outbreak of warfare that would lead to a disruption in oil supplies. They have no sentimental feelings with the people running Iran whatsoever. So, right there, in the white shirt. Next to you, Mazur.
Hi, Jonathan Kolib from the Century Foundation. I wanted to ask you a not-so-hypothetical. Middle East oil is finite. It will run out at some point. I'm curious how that affects this triangular relationship, and are we doing enough to position ourselves for that strategic environment? And are we doing enough, perhaps, to wean the Middle East off Middle East oil now?
Sure, why don't you go first?
The answer is no, we're not doing anything at all to wean the Middle East off its dependence on oil. And people in the Middle East are not doing very much either. But you're talking about a very, very long-term issue. There's going to be oil coming out of the Middle East for a long, long time to come. It's going to cost more and more per barrel, but it will come out. And this question you are raising in a town where 6 weeks is considered the strategic horizon. So I think the chances that we will address this question, important as it is, are not great.
There's a slide there from the Global Future Energy Shares, the Energy Information Administration came out with. The current projections are that it's very hard to change the energy mix you have all these cars. Cars are going to last for 10 years, so you're sort of locked into the consumption of cars. You have the momentum. You have all the service stations. What a transition from oil as a transportation fuel, which is principally what oil is. I mean, it's extraordinarily hard to do in any sort of compressed period of time. And you're seeing this at a time when countries like China and India are rising economically to a point where people are starting to buy personal automobiles. So it seems to me that it would have to be a tremendously disruptive event or set of events to get off this trend of really growing oil demand. The interesting part of the growing oil demand is nobody has the faintest idea where all this oil is coming from, because the sort of fudge factor has always been Saudi Arabia. Does Saudi Arabia have enough of the kind of oil we can refine to do all those kinds of things? Or the Chinese are building a refinery to deal with with this distressed Saudi crude. But for the most part, there's a whole fudge factor involved in how we supply the world with the oil that we think the world is going to use in 2030. And we don't know how to get it.
I just wanted to go back to Arno's question and John, what you said about China being worried about a conflict between Iran and the U.S. or Israel in the Middle East. If that's the case, then the Chinese need to work harder to help us make diplomacy succeed. Because right now in that group of six countries that are promoting the negotiations and the sanctions effort, the Chinese are the ones who are making it difficult for that basic strategy to succeed, in my judgment, because they're putting their economic interests over their geopolitical interests. And that's a very difficult question for any country, you know, to balance, and I understand that. I'm not trying to be too judgmental. But if there's an overt Chinese concern about the possibility of war, they can help us to strengthen diplomacy more than they are doing now.
And the Chinese argument is that they're afraid that we're going to run through all our diplomatic cards and end up where there's no alternative except warfare. That our sense of coercive diplomacy is that you have diplomacy backed by the potential of force, and that what we're doing is we're trying to play all the cards too quickly. I'm just saying what the Chinese say. We're not taking yes for an answer. We're not listening for a yes. And that what's happening is we're trying to get China on board for what is ultimately a military strike, and they're not on board for a military strike, and they don't want to get to the end of the diplomacy too quickly. I know you've probably had any number of discussions with Chinese. You've probably heard that before. It's probably frustrated you to no end. But I heard much less of it, but that's certainly what I heard.
What the Chinese have is an administration, President Bush and Secretary Rice, who for 3 years now have been involved in these negotiations with China and Russia and the Europeans to develop an effective diplomatic option. What are they waiting for? I don't understand the argument that you've just summarized from the Chinese perspective, and don't accept it.
I was actually going to address a different issue, but I think it is worth pointing out that one very widespread interpretation of the Israeli exercise in the Mediterranean, which just took place earlier this month, was that it was intended precisely not to send a signal to Iran, but to send a signal to the rest of the world that it better get serious with Iran or the Israelis would do something incredibly destructive to everybody's interests, including, I would argue, their own. So whether the Chinese want to cooperate with that kind of approach or not is something they will make their mind up on. The issue that I'd wanted to mention simply was this, going back to oil running out, that Saudi Arabia has reached the point at which it is no longer concerned under normal circumstances about losing the long-term market for oil. And therefore, it is concerned about the health of the global economy and about stability in oil markets, as it has showed over the weekend with the conference that it staged in Riyadh. But it is now not going to increase production levels above what prudent reservoir management suggests is the appropriate level. And that is probably somewhere below 12.5 million barrels a day. So we are not going to see the Saudis play the swing role in global markets that we for long were accustomed to. They lack the capacity, and they don't see the reason.
The time has hit two, and we're all going to turn into pumpkins. I would encourage you to follow up with any of us afterwards. I appreciate your coming. I certainly appreciate our other speakers who demonstrated just why they have such a towering presence in the Washington discussion, and we hope to see you again soon. Thank you.